Today is Friday, June 18th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Americans observe the Juneteenth federal holiday.
Navy says that when she was a child, her father, who was an educator, made it a tradition to celebrate Juneteenth.
Plus, North Korea prepares for dialogue or confrontation with the U.S.
Kim stressed the need for both talks and confrontation with the U.S. in order to, quote, protect the dignity of our state and its interests for independent development.
Also, UN says war and right violations have displaced more than 3 million people. Our top story today is in the U.S. Americans are observing the new Juneteenth federal holiday signed into law by President Joe Biden on Thursday. Many African-American communities have celebrated every June 19th since 1865, marking the day the last enslaved blacks learned of their freedom. It's been a day to reflect on their struggle for freedom and justice and to teach vital history to young generations. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo has more.
Across America, people have celebrated Juneteenth or Freedom Day every year since June 19, 1865. Kelly Elaine Navies is a museum specialist and oral historian at the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington.
Well, on June 19, 1865, General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas, with a force of 1,800 Union troops, many of whom were actually United States colored troops, and announced General Order 3, stating that the enslaved were now free. This was important because although the Emancipation Proclamation had been signed on January 1, 1863, that really only impacted states in the Confederacy and then only states where there was a Union presence.
Navies says that when she was a child, her father, who was an educator, made it a tradition to celebrate Juneteenth. Juneteenth has been a state holiday in nearly all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Last year, in the wake of millions demonstrating against racial injustice after the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others, a bipartisan group tried to get Congress to recognize Juneteenth as a federal holiday. On Thursday, after more than 150 years, Juneteenth was established as the newest federal holiday at a White House ceremony after a bill passed earlier this week by Congress.
It's a celebration of the emancipation of African Americans who were enslaved, but it's also a day of remembrance. So I'm eager to see not only the Juneteenth holiday be recognized by the federal government, but I'm eager to see how it is recognized, how it is celebrated, how it is used as a tool of education for people, and how it can ultimately bring us more in line with what the hope of emancipation was, which is freedom for everybody. I think it can be a positive development for good for all of us.
But Justin Hansford, law professor at Howard University, also noted the dichotomy between what happened in Washington on Tuesday and current events in the state of Texas.
On the same day that Juneteenth was passed in the Senate, the state of Texas, where Juneteenth originates from, passed a law banning the teaching of the 1619 Project, banning critical race theory, banning the opportunity to teach about Black history. So it's almost like a joke where you pass a proclamation recognizing an important moment in Black history. And at the same time, on the same day, where the state where that particular incident took place is passing a law banning the teaching of Black history.
HB 3979 is sponsored by Texas State Representative Steve Toth, who said in an interview with the National Review, the facts are very clear, very explicit. We don't ban, we don't discourage the discussion of anything. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
As the United States and its NATO allies pull their troops out of Afghanistan, civilian casualties have increased, especially among women and children. With the outlook bleak, experts are considering options to try to prevent catastrophe in the war-stricken country. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
With U.S. and NATO forces said to be out of Afghanistan this year, the future of the country is on a lot of people's minds, including U.S. President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Biden said Putin asked him about it at their summit in Geneva.
He asked us about Afghanistan. He said that he hopes that we're able to maintain some peace and security. And I said that has a lot to do with you. He indicated that he was prepared to, quote, help on Afghanistan. I won't go into detail now.
With civilian casualties almost 30% higher in Afghanistan than they were around this time last year, experts gathered remotely on Zoom for a forum held by the Center for Strategic International Studies entitled Preventing Catastrophe in Afghanistan. One of the speakers, Afghanistan's ambassador to the United Nations, Adela Raz, objected to the narrative suggested by the title.
I know we all are preparing or thinking of a worst-case scenario, but I must tell you, the catastrophe is not as magnified in Afghanistan as much as it is outside of Afghanistan. And if we look into it as a catastrophe, I think we right away question the type of investment we have made in the last 20 years and its effectiveness. So there is no catastrophe. I think it's a very difficult testing period for us.
Raz said U.S. and NATO investment in her country has paid off. She said Afghan national forces are now capable and at the forefront of fighting terrorism. But she stressed they need continued logistical and financial support so that the Taliban know they can never take over the country by force. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says the country should prepare for both dialogue and confrontation with the United States, particularly confrontation, state media KCNA reported on Friday in his first direct comment on the Biden administration. Gloria Tso of Reuters reports.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has warned of potential confrontation with the United States. That's according to the North state media on Friday. In his first comments directed at the Biden administration, Kim stressed the need for both talks and confrontation with the U.S. in order to, quote, protect the dignity of our state and its interests for independent development. He also emphasized the need to create a favorable external climate for the North's own initiatives. Kim's remarks came during a Thursday meeting of the ruling Workers' Party, after an earlier session where he called for measures to tackle a tense food situation caused by the global health crisis. Analysts say Kim is refraining from provoking the Biden administration amid reports of widespread food shortages and concerns about the spread of the health crisis, despite no official acknowledgement from his regime. Border closures have further hit the economy, already battered by international sanctions. Biden and South Korean President Moon Jae-in held their first summit in May, injecting fresh urgency into efforts to engage the North in nuclear weapons talks. North Korea lashed out at the U.S. and its allies in South Korea last month, accusing Washington of hostile policy that required a similar response from Pyongyang.
That's Gloria So of Reuters. France has proposed to the U.S. and others a plan to remove foreign fighters from Libya. The plan lays out a six-month timeline that starts with the withdrawal of Turkish-backed Syrian mercenaries, followed by Russian-backed mercenaries and regular Turkish troops. Macron's plan relies on America's influence to pressure Turkey and Russia into withdrawing their affiliated forces. Jason Peck, a fellow at the Middle East Institute and founder of the Libyan Analysis, discussed whether this is a feasible plan with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Well, this plan is merely aspirational. It isn't genuinely feasible. It ignores the realities on the ground and expresses the French wish list. It also ignores the history, which is that Turkish forces and drones were critical in winning the war for Tripoli on behalf of the GNA forces. Therefore, they have no incentive to leave. And on October 23rd, 2020, a ceasefire agreement was announced stating that all foreign forces had to leave within 3 months. But 3 months came and went, and they didn't leave. So merely the French pitching the U.S. or the UK or the UN or anyone a plan saying all the mercenaries have to leave doesn't explain at all how to get that to happen.
The idea behind Macron's plan seems to be to tap into America's influence and use it as leverage to pressure Turkey and Russia into withdrawing their affiliated forces. Could that resonate with the U.S. policy, and is the U.S. capable of playing such a role?
Well, that's exactly right. Macron's whole idea is to leverage his connection to the power of the Biden administration and the credibility that the new Biden administration brings, not only to Libya, but to all joint Western policy activities, be it combating tax havens or confronting Russia. And of course, Macron would like to get the U.S. to support his aims. His aims are to combat Turkish influence in the Mediterranean. And in a way, he's pushing very smartly on some U.S. tropes. The U.S. would like to get Russian and Turkish mercenaries out of Libya, for sure. And U.S. statements in the wake of the G7 meetings in Cornwall stress that point. But Biden has very shrewd advisors around him. Secretary Blinken is not new to the Libya issue. And Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, understands quite well that the French and Russians have an anti-Turkish and pro-Haftar position in Libya. So they're not going to fall prey to some French plan and push it as if it was neutral.
The third phase of Macron's plan proposes to reunify Libya's divided security forces, currently split between those who defended the Tripoli government and those fighting for Haftar. On Thursday, Libyan National Army announced a military operation in Fezzan due to escalating activities of the Islamic State Libya in the southwest of the country. Would that entail an imminent risk of limited clashes between LNA and some anti-LNA and loosely GNU-affiliated groups, threatening the existing ceasefire?
That's exactly right. This is the greatest threat to the October 23rd, 2020 ceasefire that we have seen in the last 9 months. And the LNA is not really mobilizing against the Islamic State in the Fezzan. That's merely the pretext. The LNA is mobilizing because they've been progressively cut out of the power politics of Libya. Ever since the GNU has gained legitimacy and Abdulhamid Dbeibah has bypassed them and made lots of business deals and proposed a budget and done a whole range of activities that a real leader should do, Haftar has found himself ignored. And therefore, what options does he have? He can either cut the oil off, or he can say, I'm fighting terrorists. I'm the legitimate force of peace in Libya. So he's done that, and he's seized on the fact that there was some ISIS activity last week to launch this offensive. I hope that it can be very quickly resolved through diplomatic means. Otherwise, limited clashes could escalate between the LNA and GNU-affiliated groups, threatening to undo all the progress that has been made in the last year and a half.
That's Jason Pack, a fellow at the Middle East Institute and founder of Libya Analysis, speaking with my colleague Mohamed El-Shenawy. Campaigning has ended ahead of Ethiopia's elections on Monday, but VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch, who is in the capital, Addis Ababa, says election preparations continue. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson a few hours ago.
In Addis Ababa, over the past few days, we have seen more political activity in the streets than I've personally ever seen in Ethiopia, and people on the streets said more than they've ever seen. Up until Wednesday night, the campaigns were going on, and there are dozens of political parties contesting, and a lot of them were having rallies or parades or driving cars around with music and slogans and balloons. And people in the streets, even those that were deeply against what the government at the moment, like people who are said that they support candidates that are in jail at the moment, there are candidates contesting from jail, were kind of amazed about how much free expression they were seeing on the streets of Addis Ababa and how new that is. The other thing we're seeing on the streets is preparation for the elections. We met with some young people that work for the National Electoral Board, and they were going from neighborhood to neighborhood, 15 spots a day, to give tutorials on how to vote. And other than that, because between Wednesday night and the vote on Monday, there is a moratorium on campaigning, and the local media isn't covering election issues for this time. So it's pretty quiet at the moment.
What is the mood among people? Are people expecting this election to bring any change, or are they rather indifferent to it?
I haven't met anybody who is indifferent. Some people are excited, some people are worried, some people are frustrated. A lot of people are excited about incremental change that is expected. The ruling party is expected to win overall nationally, and that's what has happened in every Ethiopian election. However, it is expected that possibly some opposition parties will take a majority in Addis Ababa, which is capital of the country and the financial center of the country, so it's quite important. And as one activist was saying, she was saying she's not that excited about the election. She doesn't feel like any of the political parties are really representing the needs of the people that she works for, which are women and girls. But she is excited in that she thinks it's possibly an end to Ethiopia being ruled entirely by one party without other parties having a say in government. So that could be exciting for many people. There's other people, though, who are in regions that are not voting that are either angry or not interested in the outcome because they see this election as any outcome would be just solidifying a government they don't support.
That's VOA's correspondent Heather Murdoch speaking with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson from Addis Ababa. Iranians are voting in a presidential election that the hardline protege of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is expected to win. This had led to low turnout and calls for a boycott. Polls opened at 7 a.m. local time Friday for the vote. Public apathy has been widespread after a panel Khamenei oversaw barred hundreds of candidates, including reformists, and those aligned with the departing President Hassan Rouhani. Sanam Vakil, Deputy Director and Senior Research Fellow, Middle East and North African Program at Chatham House, said a conservative victory under the leading candidate, Ebrahim Raisi, could make it easier to create a broad internal consensus on domestic reform before a successful Khamenei is identified. However, Sanam said a Raisi victory likely precludes meaningful liberalization of the political system and shows the conservative establishment is confident in pushing its agenda. This is the Voice of America. The United Nations Refugee Agency says war, violence, persecution, human rights violations, and other factors caused nearly 3 million people to flee their homes last year, even though the COVID-19 crisis restricted movement worldwide. In its latest Global Trends report, UNHCR said Friday that the world's cumulative number of displaced people rose to 82.4 million, a new post-World War II record. Israel says it will transfer around 1 million doses of soon-to-expire coronavirus vaccines to the Palestinian Authority in exchange for a similar number of doses the Palestinians expect to receive later this year. Israel, which has reopened after vaccinating 85% of its adult population, has faced criticism for not sharing its vaccines with the 4.5 million Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. The agreement was announced by the new Israeli government that was sworn in on Sunday. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The United Nations warns accelerating climate change is causing a dramatic intensification of global drought disasters, which are threatening agricultural production, the world's safe water supply, and other essential aspects of human development. The UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction has launched a, quote, special report on drought 2021, unquote. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN researchers say drought has affected more people around the world in the past four decades than any other natural disaster. The UN report warns the impact of the climate-driven drought emergency on the lives and livelihoods of people across the planet will worsen in the coming years. The UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Disaster Risk Reduction, Mamie Mizutori, says drought has directly affected 1.5 billion people so far this century. She says most of the world will be living with water stress in the next few years as drought disasters grow. She says drought is a major factor in land degradation and is responsible for declining yields of major crops. She adds, shifting rainfall patterns and variability pose a risk to the 70% of global agriculture that is rainfall dependent.
A warming planet threatens to multiply the number of people without access to safe water and sanitation, thereby seriously increasing the spread of diseases, the risk of displacement, and the potential even for conflict over scarce water resources.
While droughts always have been part of the human experience, the damage and costs resulting from them are seriously underestimated. The report estimates the global economic costs arriving from drought from 1998 to 2017 of at least $124 billion. The World Health Organization considers drought to be the most serious hazard to livestock and crops in nearly every part of the world. It says water scarcity impacts 40% of the world's population. WHO projects as many as 700 million people are at risk of being displaced by 2030 because of drought. Leading co-author of the report, Roger Pulwati, agrees the data contained within the report is grim, but does not see an apocalyptic picture ahead. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
International donors pledged tens of millions of dollars worth of emergency aid Thursday to help prop up Lebanon's struggling army, a key institution for the country's stability that is lacking basics, including food. From Paris, Lisa Bryant has more for VOA on the meeting hosted by France and Italy.
Thursday's virtual meeting had an unusual cause, not to offer humanitarian aid to Lebanon's struggling poor, but to its army, teetering under the fallout of the country's worst economic crisis in more than a century. A French government statement issued after the talks said international support for Lebanon's army aimed to meet human and basic maintenance needs and was no substitute for essential reforms the country needs. An army spokeswoman told VOA the aid, worth tens of millions of dollars, targeted areas like food, fuel, and medical supplies and would be released within weeks or months. Since 2019, the Lebanese pound has lost 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar. Added to that, the government plans to cut subsidies on key goods like fuel and food.
Simple soldiers who used to earn the equivalent of $1,000 a month, roughly, now earn the equivalent of $100 because the prices have gone up dramatically.
Heiko Wiemann is Lebanon Project Director at the International Crisis Group Policy Institute.
Essentially, the soldiers are going hungry, and the budget that the army has to buy anything, need to buy spare parts, to buy whatever they need to for daily affairs, those budgets have become completely meaningless.
For Lebanon and the donor community, the funding would prop up one of the few institutions remaining above the country's deep divisions. Army Chief Joseph Aoun, who visited Paris recently, said the military was forced to turn to its allies to survive. University of Geneva International Relations Professor Hasni Abidi says for the international community, the implications of letting Lebanon's army collapse are too big. A failed army means a failed state, a population in deep trouble, and victory for Iran-backed Hezbollah, the military group dominating Lebanon's power structure. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Denmark's players want to pay their supporters back for the support they have shown after Christian Eriksen's collapse at the European Championship. They have one last chance to do so when they face Russia in Copenhagen on Monday. A win could be enough to see them reach the next round of Euro 2020. Denmark's midfielder Pierre-Emil Højbjerg says the tribute to Eriksen by fans during Thursday's game against Belgium was, quote, very, very powerful, unquote. Now he wants to, quote, pay them back with everything you have, unquote. And that's what we're going to do on Monday, he said. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great weekend.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events.